Reverend Man, since last week, you broke us in real good, okay?
Okay.
So now you're going to feel like you're right in the midst of the yeshiva.
Okay.
And they're taking the gloves off and they're going to ask you questions.
Okay, go right ahead.
And we'll go from there. So who's going to do the first one? All right, this is Gary Buchanan. And Gary is one of our young men that's almost 40 years old. So he'll ask, he's going to ask you the first question, and we'll go from there, okay?
Sure, guys.
Thank you very much.
Hello?
Rabbi, last week you spoke of sacrifices. My question is, according to Torah, what is the origin of sacrifices?
That's a very good question. What I was talking about last week was the position, as I said, the position of Maimonides, and there is an argument. There's a very significant dispute between Maimonides and Nachmanides, known in Hebrew as the Ramban, on the purpose of sacrifices. Now, I mentioned the position of Maimonides, who says that the reason why the Torah incorporated, I'll get to the point of where it originates in a minute, I just want to review the position, that the Torah only included sacrifices in the system of mitzvot because of historical circumstances. That is to say that people became attached to that mode of worship. And it would have been impossible to establish any kind of a religion at that time without in some way gratifying the emotions of sacrifice. And what the Torah did was to incorporate, to attach a system of sacrifice which was based not upon the primitive emotions, the idolatrous emotions, but as I pointed out, which were based upon halacha, conceptual ideas, and therefore it would take those emotions and allow to draw the person closer to the Torah and to enable him to satisfy those emotions only through a system which was based upon true ideas. So what Maimonides is saying is that through that mechanism, the Torah purified would take a person who by nature has these primitive emotions and would utilize the system of halacha to purify him of those emotions and to raise him to a higher level. However, Nachmanides disagrees, and he raises some very, very strong questions, which perhaps you might have thought of yourself, because we see that sacrifice dates back to the earliest days. For example, in the Torah, the first individual to bring a sacrifice was Cain and Hevel. Actually, Hevel was the first one. Abel, in English, it's Abel. He brought a sacrifice. It says from the fattest of his sheep, from the choicest of his sheep. And then, in fact, this played a very significant role in the first case of murder that the Torah records. And then it says that Cain also brought from the fruits of the earth, he brought a sacrifice to God. And as we know, God rejected the sacrifice of Cain, and God accepted the sacrifice of Abel, and this triggered off the hostility. Of course, Cain felt depressed at the fact that he was rejected by God, but he couldn't face up to it. And as we know, in many cases, when a person cannot face up to his own shortcomings, what he simply does is he displaces his anger, which would be directed against himself, but he displaces it against other people, those who were favored. So you see that an individual such as Abel, who was a righteous person, brought sacrifices, and he was on a very high level, and he didn't partake of the primitive emotions. As we read on in the Torah, we see other great individuals brought sacrifices. In fact, that's the story of what's known as the Akedah. God commanded Abraham to sacrifice his son. Of course, it was a test of Abraham, and at the very last moment, Abraham was told not to do it, but then Abraham grabbed a ram in its place, and he sacrificed a ram to God. So, and we see other examples in the Torah of great individuals amongst the patriarchs, Jacob brought sacrifices to God. So if that is the case, this is Nachmanides, one of Nachmanides' powerful questions. If that's the case, then how can you say that there's something wrong with sacrifices, and that it is the Torah included it only as a concession when we see that great individuals, amongst them Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, brought sacrifices, and this is a very good way of relating to God. That's one of the arguments of Nachmanides, and I think it's a very powerful argument. So, if you want to know the origin, according to the Torah, the historical origin, it would seem that it did originate with in the earliest times. It doesn't mention anything about Adam bringing a sacrifice, but as I said, his two sons, Cain and Abel, both brought sacrifices, and one was pleasing to God, and one was not. I failed to mention the case of Noah. When Noah came off the ark, one of the first things that he did was to bring a sacrifice to God. And it says, of course, it's using anthropomorphic type of language. We can't take it literally, but it says that God smelled the pleasing aroma, which means that we have to translate it into the proper terms. It means that God approved that there was this act of sacrificing to God after the devastation of the flood, and he was saved from the flood, was something which God approved of. So that I believe, is a very powerful question, which, of course, Nachmanides doesn't fail to direct against Maimonides, with whom he disagrees. Historically, then, according to the Torah, sacrifice dates back to the earliest times, and in fact, it would seem that it's something which is very pleasing to God. It's also true that the institution of sacrifice seems to be part and parcel of every, as you mentioned last week, somebody mentioned paganism. It's definitely associated with primitive religions as well. So, both, you know, you have both factors. I mean, it originated, according to the Torah, as I said, with great individuals who had a correct notion of God and who related to God in the proper way. Certainly an individual like Abel, certainly an individual like Noah, and certainly the fact that Abraham was commanded to sacrifice his only son, and his willingness to do so was accounted as something, of course, it was one of the 10 tests of Abraham, was an act of greatness. And as I said, even though it was a test, and God never intended to have him actually kill Isaac, but when he was told not to go ahead with it, he then proceeded. There was a ram nearby in the bushes, and he took the ram, and he offered the ram as a sacrifice to God. So we see, and certainly Abraham represents the highest level of belief in God and having the proper relationship with God. So, this is the basis. There's a basis here for a dispute. What Maimonides is saying, I don't think Maimonides would dispute that. I think he means to say that the question, when you boil down to it, why did the Torah incorporate the institution of sacrifice as one of the 613 commandments? And I think, this is my personal theory as to the understanding of the argument, I think that Maimonides wouldn't argue that there are tremendous benefits in bringing a sacrifice. And if it's done properly by the proper individual with the proper motives, it certainly can elevate an individual. And it's an enactment of ideas which are extremely important. In the case of the Akedah, for example, it meant that a person is willing to subjugate his entire existence to the will of God. And even in a case where it goes against his most powerful emotions, that was the love that Abraham had for his son. And not just the fact that he was able to overcome his most powerful emotions, but also his entire sense of right and wrong. And most people cannot give up their own sense. That's just another form of idolatry, the overestimation of man's own ideas, man's own morality. Today, it doesn't. Many people that don't follow the Torah doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have a system of morality, but they follow the whims of their own heart, their own imagination. That is the overestimation of their own sense of what's right and wrong. Now, certainly, to be able to be able to that to slaughter one's own innocent child is something which makes absolutely no sense to an individual. I mean, that after all these years, when he was an old man, God miraculously would cause him to have a son and for a whole purpose and so on and so forth, and then this child who did nothing wrong, totally innocent, and God demands that he be killed, is something which goes completely counter to human reason. And the greatness of Abraham in this case is that he's able to put aside all of his emotions and his entire sense of what's right and what's wrong in his recognition that his own understanding of things is so feeble compared to the creator of the universe that he has to go along with whatever God demands, and he overcomes his personal emotions. So in certain situations, in the right circumstances, there's no doubt that sacrifices can be a very positive kind of a thing. I just want to bring in the reason that Nachmanides gives for the whole institution is essentially part of the mechanism of tshuva, which means repentance. And that is to say that when a person sins and he has to realize that he's simply gone down to a lower level, he's given into the instinctual self, and that if an individual, if man, who was designed to live in accordance with his divine image, if he behaves like an instinctual being, he's not worthy of existence. Now, of course, these are the underlying ideas, and he has to repent, he has to change his ways, and he has to subjugate those instincts which caused him to sin. But why does he have to bring the actual sacrifice? The actual sacrifice is an enactment, is a concrete enactment of the ideas which he has to arrive at in his own heart. The point is, the way man is structured, man is not an angel. Man is has the capacity to live in accordance with ideas, but he's an instinctual being. He has emotions. And it's not enough. It's not enough for him simply to sit back and to think these ideas through. It makes a tremendous impact on his emotions when he acts out these ideas. When he takes an animal, which is a living being, which has instincts, with which there is a certain identification, and he brings it before the altar, and he sacrifices, which means that it draws home to him his own mortality, his own place in the universe. In a certain sense, that's really what should be happening to him. Because if he deviates from the plan of God, and he allows his entire life to be taken over by his instinctual side, then he's not living a human existence, and he's worthy of destruction. Now, God, in his compassion for us, does not destroy us, but he gives us an opportunity to recognize this and to change course. Without that ability to change course, we would all be doomed. But the question is like this: is it sufficient simply to sit back and to go through all of these ideas in your mind and to reach this conclusion? Or is it necessary, in order for these ideas to make the proper impact on your emotions, to actually enact them in a very dramatic way, which has a very strong impact on the emotions? Now, that's the position of Nachmanides, that essentially the institution of sacrifices is a very important device in the perfection of man, and it especially in the tshuva. And lest you ask, well, if that's the case, what was, for example, Abel, who brought a very pleasing sacrifice, what was he repenting for? And because he hadn't sinned, it doesn't mention that he had sinned. I would say that by repentance, we don't mean necessarily when a person commits a sin, but man by nature must always be involved in self-evaluation, and he has to be scrutinizing and monitoring his emotions. And when he sees that it says that he too is attracted. The rabbis state it's based upon the way the sentences are structured, that he too was attracted to work the soil. That was the attraction of Cain. It was a significance in his defect, was that he had an excessive attachment to the materialistic, and that's why he decided to work the soil. And Abel was attracted to it too, but he pulled away because he recognized that God, so to speak, had cursed the earth. That was the curse of Adam, and which meant to say that it entailed a tremendous amount of labor. And rather than be involved in this labor, to have excessive physical possessions which he didn't need, he wanted to free himself so that he could be involved in the service of God. But he brought a sacrifice. And the sacrifice was important to bring home to him the idea that he's not to get too attached to the physical, and that the physical is simply a means to the spiritual. So that is the basic concept, as I understand it, according to Nachmanides. And I would say that I don't think Maimonides would disagree with this idea. How can you argue with this? We see that great men who were far from idolatry, the furthest removed from idolatry, did engage in the institution of sacrifice, and it was deemed as a good thing. It says God smelled the pleasant aroma, and that's when God made the promise that he would never bring a plague to destroy mankind again. So obviously this is very pleasing, the activity. I think Maimonides, though, is talking about...
Rabbi?
I'm sorry.
Okay. I think we pretty well got that one.
Okay, please cut me off.
All right. Now, the next one. This is John Miller.
Yes.
And John is going to... He said that his was going to be a three-parter.
Oh, boy.
So, we'll try to be...
Try to be brief, in other words.
Yes, answered adequately, and let's try to get brief so we can get all three parts in there.
Okay.
And we'll go from there.
So
now,
go ahead. And don't, you know, cut me off anytime.
No, okay, all right, no problem. All right, here's what I think that, and I'm going to come back in. Gary had a couple other things to say, and I'm going to make my statement on the thing.
Sure.
See, the problem that I have with some of the things that you said about the sacrifices, Rabbi Chait and I have discussed this in detail, that the sacrifice is applied to the primitive nature of man.
Right.
That's what you said. But yet, the bottom line is that we have in the Torah, in Bereshit, we have in the very beginning, we have sacrifices that these people obviously learned from God because idolatry was not present at that time. And so how can we say that it was good and then man perverted it and we realize that did happen, but there's got to be an acceptable Torah standard for sacrifices?
Well, I was trying to address.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
You know, the prophets criticized the Jews.
Right.
Many times. Samuel said, "Hath the Lord?"
All right, go ahead, Don. Turn it up.
I'm sorry.
No, I told Don to turn the microphone up just a little.
Yeah, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord?
Right.
And so on and so forth. There's many statements in which the prophets criticized.
Well, see, I think the criticism from the prophets is not so much for the sacrifice, but it was for the lack of intensity and dedication in the offering of the sacrifices.
Well, that is true. There's no question about that. And then it can become corrupted and can
right.
enable a person to regress back to his primitive emotions. I think that the point over here is that it's a double-edged sword.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's let John Miller, and John is, if you have a problem understanding this question, we'll restate it for him, because sometimes John starts asking the question and he'll go for a while. Now look, see, John, everybody's agreeing with me. He'll start asking a question, and then in his questioning, I'll lose it.
Okay.
So if you lose it, don't feel free to ask him again.
Okay,
and we'll interpret for him.
Okay, good.
All right, here he is, John Miller.
Rabbi, I've got three basic statements to make, and see if you can answer these. Who taught the sacrificial system?
Excuse me. You have to speak a little bit louder.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Can you hear now?
Yes.
Okay. The first question is, who taught the sacrificial system to Cain and Abel?
Okay.
The second one will be along these lines is, was the system that was taught to Cain and Abel, is this the same system that became your oral tradition as such? Thirdly, if all forms of pagan religion use the animal sacrifice, then why did Moshe institute a parallel system?
Okay, those are the three. Is that it?
That's it.
I got it.
John, I think I understand.
Hey,
John is going to have to write all his questions down in the future, because that is truly concise, and that was good.
I hope I can be as concise. The first question, as to who taught, I'm just going to have to speculate on that. I could do some further research, But I would imagine that it was not taught, that this was an idea that, as I said, Abel was the first, Cain and Abel brought sacrifices, and they were not instructed to do so. And I think that they arrived at this idea on the basis of their own reason, that they thought it would... I'm not aware that there was any specific revelation. They certainly were not commanded at this point. They were only commanded in the seven Noahide laws, so, and sacrifices is not one of them. So, therefore, I would say that it's something which appealed to their reason as a way of serving God. And I tried to explain before some of the positive aspects of sacrifices, concept of identification and so forth, the concept of divesting yourself, of detaching yourself from excessive attachment to the physical. So I'll just leave it at that in terms of that question. The second, as far as the system that we have, the system that we have of sacrifices, it seems to me, and by the way, it's not just Maimonides. I quoted to you last week the view of Rashi, which is based upon the statements of the rabbis in the Talmud, that the Passover sacrifice clearly was required to cleanse the Jews. So sacrifice is now being brought into the picture as a means of cleansing the Jews. So it seems then that when people deviate and get mired in paganism, and then sacrifices, of course, is very, very appealing to paganistic emotions, and then you have a system of sacrifices which is corrupt. And the Torah had to deal with that. The Torah couldn't simply ignore it, and the Torah couldn't simply tell people to repress it. So therefore, the Torah now came along with specific laws and a specific system of sacrifices which was revealed to Moses, and it became part of the Torah system, which is intended now to cure them of their false and idolatrous ideas. In other words, part of the system of Torah, you see, part of the system of Torah, you can't, it's very difficult to avoid Maimonides' point, because when the Torah was given, it was given at a time when mankind, the majority of mankind, had become lost in paganism. And had mankind not become lost in paganism, had Adam and all the successors retained the correct idea of God, then the Torah would have been different, according to Maimonides. But part of the Torah was essential now in order for people to retain the true ideas of God and not to get stuck in paganism, was to have a remedy for paganism. And the remedy was to establish a sacrificial system which would cure the person of his false ideas by forcing him to subject all of these emotions to a completely different kind of a system which is based upon halacha, an abstract concept. So therefore he would purify himself. And that was due to, that came about because of what happened historically. So therefore my answer to your second question is that no, the sacrificial system pre-Torah was different, clearly different, than the one which is post-Torah. Pre-Torah was brought essentially by great figures who were motivated by the proper incentive, and it was not intended as a corrective measure against idolatrous emotions, as opposed to the Korban Pesach. As I quoted to you, Rashi quotes the verse which says, pull and take, pull away from your idols and grab onto a sheep of mitzvah. That's the
Rabbi,
question. Yes,
in,
question.
Well, that same thought there,
yeah, yes.
Based on the logic that you just stated, was Moses a pagan?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't know why, I don't see how that follows from what I'm saying. It wasn't for the sake of Moses that the institution was established. Absolutely not. Moses would not have needed. See, Moses was on a totally different level. I mean, many of the mitzvot, you're dealing with an individual who was perfected, and see, you have to realize that the Torah, as I mentioned last week, the Torah does not presuppose a person who has freed himself from all of his emotions, whether they be instinctual, whether they be idolatrous, and so on and so forth. The Torah presupposes that a person is going to have the ordinary emotions. And we have to transform this individual into one who is living according to exalted ideas. But how do you do so? I mean, if the Torah would have remained in a abstract, in a form of abstract philosophy, then who would it appeal to? And in fact, I think, as I mentioned last week, That was the question of Moses at the burning bush. What is the merit of this people? Why do you intervene for them? Because he understood that God had that God wanted to give them a system of true ideas, but as he looked at them, he saw they're on a low level. How can they relate to these ideas? And the answer was that through my system of mitzvot, there is no other system in the world. It's a system which, to a certain extent, takes man as he is, appeals to his religious emotions because he has a need for religious emotions, but in the satisfaction of those emotions, he must undergo a transformation and become a thinking individual. And once he does so, he's now in a different orbit. You see, that is the uniqueness of the Torah, and there is no other system like it. At bottom, you translate the mitzvot, it all translates into abstract ideas. But you can't present it to a people in the form of abstract ideas, because how many people are interested in ideas? But the entire world is religious, so therefore the genius, the divine wisdom of the system, was to incorporate these abstract true ideas into a system of practices and religious ceremonies which would engage the religious emotions, but draw the line and cause a person to subject them to a discipline of philosophical ideas and thereby transform them. That's the essence of the Torah system in a nutshell. Okay, well, I forgot the third question. I got carried away over here.
Okay, you're doing good. Now, the reason I asked this on the Moses that set the stage, and I was confident that would be your answer, was Moses a pagan?
No.
The answer, I expected that. No,
absolutely.
All right, but were the rest of the descendants of Jacob pagans then? Because he gave the laws to them, and if this is a parallel system, according to the Rambam in the guide, that the sacrificial system was a weaning process. In Book 3, Chapter 29, he deals with that. So were
stay in Egypt, and the fact they were affected by the culture of Egypt, the Jews, many of them were affected, and they became exposed to certain paganistic practices. There's no question about that as far as... That's what I said.
Okay, you said that's what you said. Yeah. What did this do to God's promise to Abraham and also Jacob that their descendants would be strangers in a foreign land?
Yeah. And God told Moses, when Moses was on the mountain, about the sin, that they've become corrupted. And the God said, now let my anger... He said to Moses, leave me be, let me alone, and my anger will kindle against them, and I'll destroy them, and I'll make a new nation out of you. Now, of course, Moses argued in return, remember the promise to the fathers. Okay, we have to... It's a separate discussion, what's going on over there. But the point is that God's position is that this people has become totally corrupt, and they can't fulfill the mission that I've designated for them, so then they have to be destroyed. And my objective will be fulfilled in a different way. So it is true that God made these promises, and God said that because of what he had done, he'd be the father of a nation. But in order to fulfill that, in order to facilitate that, the Jews had to be brought to the level where they could accept the Torah. And this commandment of the Passover sacrifice was essential to that. It doesn't mean that magically all this is going to happen. It means that God is going to set up the circumstances which will enable them to succeed. But they still will retain their free will. And they have to pass this test. And they did. But, I don't see if there's any contradiction between the two. And does that answer it? Because I just want to leave it unanswered. Hello?
Rabbi, yes. Another question I have, though.
Yes.
You say that God was going to allow them their free will,
yeah,
and that they had to come along themselves, and that if they hadn't have chosen to do this, then what I gather, God would have left them in Egypt. But if free will was involved in here, how would God have come about and given the land to the descendants of Abraham, because this has been promised, if they hadn't accepted this by free will?
See, I don't take it to, the promise and so forth. to be understood in the same way. God made promises to Abraham and so forth, and yet we see that after he fought the war, you know, to save his nephew Lot, I don't know if you know the story in Genesis, and God came to him and said, "Do not be afraid, Abraham. I will protect you." And the rabbi said that he was afraid that he had lost his merit because of the souls he had killed in war and so forth. The idea being that even though God has promised something, the promise is contingent upon an individual being worthy of it and meriting it. Now, receiving the Torah and fulfilling the Torah and so on and so forth is something which can only come about through a person's free will. And God does not interfere with a person's free will. That's one of the foundations of our system. So, as far as that's concerned, we can understand. I mean, I can answer your question one of two ways. We can understand the promise to mean that God has designated this people, and God is going to give them all of the opportunities which will enable them to reach the objective, to receive the Torah, to inherit the land, and so forth. Or else God is revealing the future, which God knows. And you're getting into a different issue now, because then the question that you're really getting at is there a contradiction between God's foreknowledge of everything, that God knows the future, and with man's free will? That's a separate topic. But if you take, let me just see if I can clarify this. When God promised to Abraham, if God was revealing the future, what's going to happen in the future, it means that God knows the future, right? If that's the case, because God knows what is going to happen. God knew that the Jews would perform the Passover sacrifice. God knew that the Jews would opt to receive the Torah. And that, however, does not conflict with the idea of free will, because Judaism believes that God has knowledge of everything that's going to happen. God's omniscient. God knows what's going to happen in the future. God does not obtain any new knowledge. And at the same time, this does not interfere with man's free will. That's a big philosophical issue which Maimonides addresses. And that's one way of looking at it. Or one can say that God made promises to Abraham, which meant to say that God's providence would be upon his children, and God would give them all the opportunities needed, but they would have to make the right choices. And the Jews did make the right choices. You can accept either interpretation, and I think we've resolved the contradiction that you're alluding to. Yeah, I'm finished with my answer on that one.
Okay.
I'm trying to, you know.
Okay.
You
can tell everybody was in deep meditation on that one.
Well, I hope if I didn't answer it, if I'm not clear, just tell
see,
me. I don't want to just, you know, leave you like hanging like that.
We kicked this thing around. In fact, I had a two-hour discussion today. Bill Harris was present with a guy about free will and predestination.
Well, that's a big topic, but
yeah.
I'd rather treat that in a separate, you know.
Yeah, well, I understand that, and we've dealt with it before. We've dealt with it.
Did you do it through Maimonides?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
All right, but we're still grappling with that one.
Okay.
All right. Now, does anyone else have a question on these lines, and we can let him get back to Passover? Now, I've got one question. Before we get back to it, because you alluded to prayer last week, I told you we were going to get on the questions.
Yeah, I'm very happy about this. Go right ahead. Don't apologize.
Okay. Now, has anyone else got anything? Laura, you got all this? Sandra, you got Misty? You got it? You did it right in there? No, we're not going to do that. Peggy, you got one? You got it? You ready? Betty, you don't even know what the question was. You were here last week on that one. Becky? All right, here's mine.
Go ahead.
All right, we're going around, and you were talking about prayer last week.
Yeah.
And you said that the sages have left the examples of prayer to us.
Yeah.
All right, and you said the sages base theirs on the revelation to Moses, from Moses, excuse me, the prayers of Moses.
Right.
All right, now, the question would be that the sages, obviously, Moses were not around, when you refer to the sages, and this, am I assuming you're talking about the sages of the Second Temple period?
Yes.
Okay,
and
you're talking.
The Great Assembly.
Of the Great Assembly, beginning with Hillel, Shammai, down through Yavner.
Well, it goes back even before that. But, you know, around the time of Ezra,
Ezra, all right, Ezra and Nehemiah and the five pairings down through
the... return, you know, from
yes,
on.
Okay. All right, so when we look at that, now who taught these people to pray? Are you going to say that this was the Masorah, the transmission, the oral tradition that was given from generation to generation?
That's a very good question. If you... I don't know if you have a copy of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. If you do, of course they have English translations. Under the laws of prayer, the laws of prayer, chapter 1, he deals with the, I guess what you might call even the historical development. And according to Maimonides, the obligation of prayer is a biblical command. It's under the heading, and you shall serve the Lord your God. And that incorporates, according to Maimonides, the obligation to pray. But he says the obligation to pray, according to Torah law, is basically only once a day, and it just incorporates certain basic ideas. That is to say, there are three elements in prayer, according to Maimonides: to extol the greatness of God, and to beseech God for your needs, and then to give praise and thanksgiving to God. Now, according to Maimonides, for many years, each person, there was no set text, in other words. There was no set form or text, but a person, to the best of his ability, would enunciate own prayers to God. But at this time, to the men of the Great Assembly, due to the fact that the Jews had been in Babylon and they had lost command of the language and they couldn't formulate their prayers properly, at this point it was decided that it was essential to have a standardized text. And the men of the Great Assembly got together and they formulated all of the prayers, the daily prayers, the Sabbath prayers, the holiday prayers, and in doing so, they based themselves on the verses, the relevant verses in the Torah, the prayers of Moses, and not just that, but on the relevant, the Psalms. The Psalms is a very significant source. And using their tremendous wisdom, they put together, we know it's called the Shemoneh Esrei, actually it's 19, the 19 blessings which form the daily prayers which we recite three times a day. And so this, however, would be a rabbinic requirement. The prayer that we recite every day, the three prayers, are fulfilling a rabbinic requirement. According to Maimonides, we fulfill our biblical requirement by praying just once a day. And the text that we have is something which was enacted by the rabbis. That's not, in other words, the text of the prayer is not come down to us from the Masorah, as you mentioned. Although the individuals who formulated it were the masters of the Masorah, and of course they were the masters, they knew all of the appropriate ideas and so forth. That's my answer.
All right, hey, you're catching on good on this.
Yeah, I'm trying to,
Yeah, you're doing well. All right, does anyone else have anything? All right, you've got about 12 minutes left if you want to get into finishing up what you started last week. On the Pesach, or we can terminate here. If you don't, that doesn't give you a whole lot of time to get things going. You've got about 10 minutes.
Well, okay, let me just, I can't start a new topic, but as long as we're on this topic,
okay.
I would just like to toss out an idea to you, what you think of it.
Right.
Maybe this will support what I've said.
Okay, well, you got about 10 to do it then. Okay.
You can cut me off whenever you want.
Okay, sure thing.
Now, do you have the text, the Chumash in front of you? Hello?
Do I have the what in front of us?
The Torah.
Yes.
Okay, so if you have your text, you can turn to Numbers. Numbers chapter 9. This is the section of the Torah which is known as, in Hebrew, it's Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach. Now, this takes place in the second year after the Jews had left Egypt. So this is would be the first year that the Jews had to celebrate Passover after the Exodus from Egypt. And God commanded them, God commanded Moses in the desert of Sinai to bring the Passover sacrifice on the 14th day of the month in the afternoon and so forth, according to all the laws and statutes. And then it says that the Jews obeyed and the Jews brought the Passover at the designated time. Now, if you go to verse 6, it's very interesting. It says there were people that were unclean, ritually impure. For example, they'd come in contact with a dead body, and that renders a person to be ritually impure, and he can't partake of sacrificial food at that time. And they couldn't bring, so they were eliminated from bringing the Passover sacrifice at that time. They came before Moshe and Aaron on that day, and these men said to him, "We are impure because we've become defiled by contact with a dead body. Why should we be held back from bringing the sacrifice of God in his designated time amongst the children of Israel?" So what they were saying was basically that through no fault of their own, they couldn't bring the sacrifice on the 14th day of Nisan. And Moses said to them, "Stand here and listen what God will command to you," which indicates parenthetically Moses' total confidence that he was able to communicate with God at any time. And God said to Moshe, to Moses, "Speak to the children of Israel and say, any man of you, if he be unclean to a dead body, or if he be on a far away, let's say he happens to be out of town, he happens to be in a different country at that time, and whether it be now or in the future, and he shall keep the Pesach, he wants to keep the Pesach, he shall do it in the second month, which would be Iyar, on the 14th of the month in the afternoon, he shall do it, together, and eat it together with matzah and bitter herbs, and so on and so forth. He can't leave over any meat until the morning," all the laws that pertain, which we discussed last week. Then it concludes this by saying that if he be pure, that is to say eligible, and he not be far away, and he fails to bring this a sacrifice, then he shall be cut off, his soul shall be cut off from its nation. For he has not brought the sacrifice of God in his designated time, and this man shall carry his sin. Therefore, what happened was that the Jews who could not bring it, through no fault of their own, because they were someplace else, they were in a distant place, or because they were in a state in which they couldn't bring it, they appealed to Moses. And God commanded Moses and instituted a new law, which was the second. It's called Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach, on the 14th day of the following month. Now, a student of mine one time asked me, which I consider to be a very good question, on the basis of all the principles of Jewish law, we have an established principle that if a person cannot fulfill a mitzvah because of circumstances beyond his control, he's exempt. So, any, and that's it. If a person is sick and he can't sit in the sukkah on the holiday of Sukkot, or if a person can't eat matzah because of, as I said, because of illness, or let's say the Jews had been in countries where they weren't permitted to eat matzah or to get matzah, etc. The general principle is if you can't perform the mitzvah, so you're exempt. So now the question he asked was, why should it be any different over here? These individuals weren't culpable, they weren't liable, because they couldn't bring the Passover due to circumstances beyond their control. So there was no negligence, and there was no breaking of the law. So why, we don't find this by any other mitzvah, that if a person can't build a sukkah, so he has another chance to do it. He can only do it in a designated time. So I was trying, in fact, that was the question which got me into thinking about the entire class that I gave last week, all the various ideas about the significance of the Passover sacrifice. I would like to tie it in. I think that the mitzvah of the Passover sacrifice is different than any other mitzvah. If it's just a question of observing a mitzvah, so then you follow the rules of mitzvah. That is to say, extenuating circumstances, you're exempt. But the mitzvah of Passover is tied in with the entire fulfillment of the Torah. What is the essence? What's the purpose of all the mitzvahs? Is I am the Lord your God. That was the first of the Ten Commandments. And that is a commandment to believe in the Lord your God and to purify yourself and to have a proper relationship with God. If a person does not fulfill that commandment, then all the other commandments are meaningless. They're all null and void, because everything else that we do is to bring us closer to God, but that's only if we have a foundation of belief in God himself, the proper belief. Now, in order to achieve that, in order to achieve the proper relationship of I am the Lord your God, it's essential for man to divest himself of the idolatrous emotions. Now, man by nature has a primitive part to him, and man by nature is an idolater. You see, primitive people by nature will turn to idolatry because they have very, very powerful emotions. And it's essential for man, in order to relate to God in the proper way, to overcome his idolatrous emotions, to overcome that primitive side of his personality. And if he cannot do that, then he can never reach the level of I am the Lord your God. So that's why they turn to Moses in just this particular case, just this particular mitzvah, because they recognize its importance. They weren't saying that we're going to be punished because we failed to bring the sacrifice. That is not the case. Technically speaking, they were exempt and they wouldn't be punished. But they recognized the tremendous importance because they looked into their own natures and they saw how important it was to go through this procedure. That's why it's called the sacrifice of the Lord. Every sacrifice is brought to God, but this is the sacrifice of the Lord because it's tied in with overcoming one's primitive emotions and enabling an individual to relate to God in the proper way. That's why they appealed. Why should we be held back? Why should we lose out? We're going to lose out on a benefit. Forget about the commandment, whether we'll fulfill a commandment or not a commandment. But the very process is essential in order to perfect us. And that's why God responded and gave them another opportunity to fulfill this command. And it corresponded. I think there's a connection, because there's a connection between the holiday of Passover and the holiday of Shavuot, which takes place 7 weeks, and we count the days. We count the days, 49 days, from the time of the Exodus until the time when the Jews received the Torah on Mount Sinai. So 1 month later, they're still counting the days. We're still in that period of time in which we are preparing to go from the state of the primitive and overcoming that state. That's stage number one. And the objective, of course, is not just to overcome the primitive side, but to reach the ultimate level of I am the Lord your God, and to have the proper relationship with God. So I think that's essential, that every person has to be aware of the fact that he partakes of these emotions. Of course, as we see in the Jewish world, unfortunately, in the religious world at large today, people still maintain these primitive emotions. They may not come out in the overt form, but certainly you know that there's many superstitions and warding off evil eyes and so on, and this idea of deification of certain objects. You see it even, unfortunately, even in Israel today, when people visit graves and they attribute the tremendous powers to praying at a certain gravesite. This idea of deification of objects stems from the primitive superstitious side of man, which we always have to battle and overcome. And I think that will help us to explain that chapter concerning what I said is the Pesach Sheni, the second Passover. I'm going to stop here unless I have more time.
That's a good place. All right. And we appreciate you sharing your time with us. And I suppose Rabbi Chait or yourself will be back with us next week. I don't know what schedule is.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it, especially all the questions. I'm very happy about the fact that there were many questions.
Okay.
And anytime you want to speak to me, I'll be available.
Okay. I certainly appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.